The woods were so close you could not go through with a car. Except for the landing tracks from the two beam ships, only a single set of footprints led from one of the tracks to the edge of the woods and back again. Untouched, the rest of the grass still stood stiff and tall around the 6-foot counterclockwise swirls so precisely pressed into tracks. And the meadow in which they lay seemed the perfect place to hold a secret rendezvous, nearby. But secluded and quiet, a thick growth of trees formed a wall over 100 feet tall to hide the landing and departure of a strange lighted craft. "The pictures were special," said Herbert, "but when we stood in the woods at this surrounded place and saw the tracks, it was special, special, special. I had never seen that before. It's difficult for me to explain." Standing at the edge of the forest, Schutzbach explained to Herbert and Harold how the Pleiadians guided Mia telepathically to the chosen site, then landed their ship and disembarked to speak with him unless they desired either to teleport Mia into the ship's hold or break him down and reassemble him instantaneously on board. After Herbert had taken several pictures of the landing tracks, some at a distance, some up close enough to see into the swirls of grass, the three men returned through the forest to the cars and drove back to Hinwe. By that time Mia had returned, his wife told them, but he could not meet with them now. He would meet them in the city of Wetzikon at the post restaurant near the railway station at 5 p.m. After seeing the many photographs in the albums and viewing the landing tracks, Herbert and Harold now thought Eduard Mia was far more intriguing than portrayed in the simple article that only several hours earlier had persuaded them to drive over 300 miles to Hinwe. Each was far from accepting the reality of the contacts, yet the man's story, from what they had seen, had some substance to it. More than before, they wanted to meet Mia and question him to see if this knowledge from the Pleiadians seemed genuine or was filled with the contradictions of one obviously in touch with no source but his own earthly imagination. They drove alone to Wetzikon and arrived at the post restaurant just before 5 o'clock. About 30 minutes later, as they sat talking at an outside table, Mia walked up in the company of the Schutzbach brothers and extended his hand to Herbert. "I never saw him before," Herbert said later, "only the picture in the magazine. And he came straight to me, extended his hand, and said, 'Hello.' It was a strange feeling when I looked into his eyes, like, I know this man. I don't know his voice and laughter, but I look at the eyes. I know this man." For the next 3 hours on that warm summer evening, the five men sipped hot coffee and iced coke at a table under a shade tree. Harold questioned Mia about the photos they had seen in the albums, but Mia seemed to know little about photography. His knowledge was summed up in the phrase, "I push the button. And it works." Herbert had read many books on astronomy and space travel. He was familiar with some of the mythology behind constellations. He knew about the origins of the universe and that over 200 billion stars now spin in the slowly revolving galaxy known as the Milky Way, and that for every star in the Milky Way there was thought to be an entire galaxy in the universe. He knew, too, about the formation of star systems and the conditions necessary for the evolution of life. He even understood the basic thought behind Einstein's theory of relativity and the problems it presented for faster-than-light travel. "For 3 hours I asked questions about these things," he later said, "and all the answers came correctly, quickly, and logically." He would give an answer, and maybe 1 hour later he would give another answer to another part and it was all correct. All such brilliant logic. "I read many books. But there is no sequence inside, no logical connection, and that was the first thing I found fascinating about the conversation with Billy. He took his time and always tried to answer a question, so I was completely satisfied. We talked about his personal life, too, and he said he had only an elementary school education. I know many people who have been only to elementary school, and I've never heard any of them speak like someone with a PhD. He speaks like this, and it makes me wonder. When he speaks of certain things, I think there must be some way he knows that." See, a month later, after exchanging letters with Mia, Herbert, this time alone, drove again to Hinwe to continue quizzing the man, and he hoped to see more evidence. When he arrived on the outskirts of Hinwe, however, He detoured into the forest where Schatzbach had shown him the fresh landing tracks. Despite 2 weeks of unusually hot August weather with no rain, the grass that had been pressed into the large flat swirls continued to be green and springy. And though they were now 6 weeks old, the tracks stood out as distinctly as on the afternoon Herbert had first seen them. Like Schatzbach and others before him, he could not understand how the large counterclockwise swirls could be so precisely pressed into the tall grass without crushing it. But if the grass had been crushed, it now would be brown and dry. And since it was not brown and dry, nor crushed or broken, why did it not rise up again? For the next 5 weekends, Herbert would return to that same site, but the grass never stood, it merely continued to grow round and round in a peculiar flat swirl. Then the farmer came and cut the grass, said Herbert. The tracks still were fresh. I saw that with my own eyes. Herbert's second experience with Mia proved as intriguing as the first, and he returned again the following weekend. For hours he studied the photographs and talked to Mia about the experiences. His initial cynicism over the man and his alleged contacts slowly turned to curiosity, and for the next year he travelled every weekend to Hinwil, sometimes alone, sometimes accompanied by Harold. He stayed with the Mia family, sleeping in a small bedroom at the farmhouse and watching Mia closely. He was free to roam all levels of the house, and spoke frequently with Popeye, helping her with her German and explaining the contact notes, which she tried to understand. They developed a close friendship, as Popeye relied on Herbert for the moral support and understanding her husband now had no time to give her. But Herbert saw and heard nothing suspicious. Popeye, if she kept any secrets, divulged nothing. Herbert constantly searched but found no equipment, rigging, or models, not even scientific journals or technical books from which Mia might glean his knowledge of so many things. Mia never left the house unless it was to go on a contact, usually late at night, and no one came to the house to meet with him secretly. I saw Billy from morning to night, he later recalled, and I never saw him making things like maybe speakers. I never saw him take pictures, I never saw a model. I never saw anything that looked like a model or balloon. I knew every room in his house, and I never saw anything. That's the reason I went there. I wanted to see him do something. But I never saw anything. Month after month I stayed in Hinwil, but he did nothing, no people came, nothing. D. Herbert had known Mia for several months, when one night, after Mia had had a contact, Herbert saw a dark red light rise above a secluded wood behind the Hinwil house. The light stopped. It moved to the left, then to the right. It changed color from dark red to pale blue and back to red again. Then, it suddenly shot quickly into the sky and disappeared. Another time, on a cool summer evening about 7 or 8 o'clock, Herbert and some others were working near the Hinwil house. When Herbert looked up, he saw Mia suddenly smiling. "What's happened?" he asked. Mia replied, "I must go to a contact." Then, he ran quickly toward the woods, some distance from the house. Billy disappeared in seconds, running to the wood, Herbert said later, and then all of us, the Schatzbachs and I, maybe one other person, heard the sound. It was coming from the wood. The ethereal chords whined above the trees like no sound Herbert had ever heard. And he knew that Mia had nothing with him, nothing but a shirt and a pair of trousers. Nor, he was certain, could the sound have come from speakers wired in the trees, it seemed to emanate from no single source. "I am not crazy," said Herbert. "I listened to the sound. And the contacts continued." Nearly every weekend, when Herbert returned to Hinwil, Mia had added to the contact notes and shot more film of the beam ships. He now had taken photographs of 6 variations of Pleiadian spacecraft, singly and in pairs, 3, even as many as 4, hovering over a valley or just above the tree line in bright sunlight. People, who heard of Mirand, like Herbert and Harold, came to investigate for themselves, arrived filled with doubt and curiosity, but the photographs softened their skepticism, and the contact notes seemed convincing because they were, in the words of Herbert, absolutely logical. Then, Mia began taking others to the actual contacts, and though none ever participated, each had stories to tell. 2 years had now passed, and contacts that once occurred during the day, affording Mia the opportunity to take his remarkable photographs, now came later and later at night. The weather often was inclement and Mia rarely rode his moped alone into the hills. Instead, Jacobus or one of the others present when the telepathic signal came through would drive him to the appointed place, wait in the dark, and then drive him home again. In that first year since coming to Henwell, Herbert drove Mia to 5 contacts and saw him return from at least 10 others. Late one cold and foggy night, Herbert went with Mia and Jacobus to a contact. Mia wore his boots and a medium grey leather coat, and Jacobus drove the 3 of them in his blue Volkswagen, Herbert sitting in the back seat. As always, Mia sat in the front seat, giving directions as he received telepathic instructions from the Pleiadians. It was always back and forth, Herbert remembered. I never knew this area well, but I did not feel we actually traveled a very long way. We always went around and around because he wanted to be sure that no people were following. After a short time, he said, we must stop here, and then we stopped. And then he said, oh, let's go back a little bit. Then we went back about 50 or 100 meters and he said, okay, now you stop. I remember the place that night. He continued. It was a narrow dirt path, difficult for 2 cars to pass. At the left side was a little space, maybe for turning, and we stopped there. There were small trees on the left, and the main wood was on the right side. And he went to the right side over the path, and then a little bit down and into the woods. We sat in the car, then got out, walked, and looked up to the sky, but it was full of clouds and it was nighttime so you could not see anything. It was not raining, but it was wet and foggy. I stood outside with Jacobus a short time smoking a cigarette, and all my clothes became wet. We discussed nothing about the contact and nothing about Billy. We discussed cars, funny things about life, nothing special, nothing about the case. We were completely in the deepest night in the deepest woods. And we stayed with the car 2 hours waiting for him. I said, what is he doing? Then he finally came back. You're crazy, I said. You stayed a long time, it's too cold. He said, I stay in the ship, I'm not cold. I took his hand, it was quite warm. We were freezing. I said, was it nice? He said, yes. Then, I saw he was dry. When it's so wet outside the leather coat should have been wet first. But he was quite dry. And he was very happy, continued Herbert, when he came back he was always happy. Sometimes he was mad, sometimes he was sad, like everybody else. But when he came back from a contact, he was always happy, very quiet and peaceful. I think that's the word. When Herbert and Harold returned from a contact with Mia, they would all talk till 5, maybe 6, in the morning, Herbert and Harold drinking Pepsi, Mia drinking coffee with cream, and all of them smoking. They talked about space and the extraterrestrial societies that flourish there, the power they used to propel their ships, the weapons they employed, their social system and domestic concerns. They also discussed the problems of planet Earth, its true history, future wars, and prophecies. These were the most interesting nights I ever had in my life. Herbert recalled. When I spoke with him I always had the feeling he knew many, many things that other people did not know. And he had an especially good way of explaining things. But I never saw him reading science books. He never did that. And he never said to me, you must believe this or, if you do not do this you cannot have this. He was able to do to many things we never understood. Herbert found Mia's story to be completely different from what he had read in books about other so-called contactees. With the others, the writing was always from an Earth perspective. Adamski, Howard Menger, and many women say they have contacts with other intelligences from Mars or Venus, explained Herbert. I read those books, too, but I know that what's written inside is totally crazy. They say we have life on Venus, and if you go to the other side of the moon there are cows and sunshine. Or the whole Earth is watched by UFOs that control everything. or the UFO people are in the government in different countries. That's crazy. In Billy's writings, especially the first 700 pages or so of the contact notes, you always have the feeling this is not the mind of an Earth person. It's completely different. I have known Billy too long a time, and Billy is not crazy. E. Harold traveled to Hin less frequently than Herbert, though still often. One afternoon in the winter of 1977, he stood in the attic of the old farmhouse helping Mia print the contact notes. Suddenly, Mia's forehead began to glisten and his eyes closed. After a few seconds, the color returned to his face and his eyes opened once again. When Harold asked him if he was all right, Mia said only that there would be a contact later that night. In the kitchen after dark, Harold and Jacobus waited for Mia to receive another telepathic contact. About 1 o'clock, Mia came into the kitchen, saying it was time to leave. They drove in Jacobus's old blue Volkswagen for almost an hour until they reached a narrow dirt road in the forest, where Mia told Jacobus to stop. It was pitch dark, Harold later remembered. Billy said he would leave, and we had to wait there. Jacobus was so scared, he trembled. I still remember that. The night was bitter, 10 to 15 degrees below zero on the Celsius scale. While waiting for Mia to return, Jacobus stayed close to the car, but Harold, trying to keep warm, paced back and forth about 100 feet away. The two men said little to each other. Mia had not been gone long when suddenly, they heard the sound of the beam ship. Months earlier, Harold had heard the original cassette of the sounds, the ones recorded the afternoon Hans Schatzbach had stood in a field with Mia and listened to the eerie resonance until the police came. Harold had noted immediately that there were other sounds as well on the tape: a car horn, a dog barking in the background. Now, as he stood in the dark and the cold listening to the strange warbling noise, he strained to hear the telltale bark of a dog or the honk of a horn, either of which would have proved to him that Mia was simply rebroadcasting the same recording. Harold had served in the army for 2 years, where he had been trained to detect the origin of sounds in the forest at night. But that night, as he listened, he had no idea from where the sound came. I tried to find out whether it came from above, below, or the side, he recalled. When you hear a sound, it reflects from the sides. But you could not know where this came from. Nor did he hear any other sound. Only the eerie pulsating of the beam ships somewhere in the sky above their heads. When the sound subsided, the walkie-talkie crackled with Mia's voice, directing them to a place about a mile away, where they found him at the side of the road waiting. As a professional photographer, Harold was even more intrigued by Mia's photographs, convinced that if Mia had faked any of the photos, he would be able to detect the forgery. He studied them constantly. In a darkroom, he himself had produced many photo montages, juxtaposing people and figures to make them appear real. I know how to do it, he said. For a montage to look real, you need a dark background. Almost all of Mia's hundreds of photos showed the beam ships in a bright blue sky, sometimes occupied by white clouds. Harold picked up one of Mia's photos as an example. I would not know how to do this. I could make a model and pull it up, but there is somebody coming by for sure, a farmer, a hunter, tourists, and they would ask, what is this man doing? Another photo, referred to as the sunlight scene, showed a beam ship hovering next to a large leafless tree at the edge of a cliff. Light from the setting sun burnished the bare branches of the tree and highlighted the curved rise of the ship. I have enlarged that picture, explained Harold. I also put the slides in the projector, and I made them small, not big, and then I looked at them with a magnifying glass. You can see more that way. You can see that the branches are in front of the ship, not behind. You must be blind not to see that. With the tree over 30 feet tall and obviously some distance from the camera, this would mean that the ship behind the branches of the tree was also a large object, as large as the 21 feet Mia had claimed. Harold once sneaked into Mia's locked study and carefully went through every drawer, box, and shelf, searching for models, sketches, experimental film, anything to indicate that Mio had somehow fabricated the photos or any of the other evidence. He found nothing. One of the most convincing things Herbert ever witnessed Mia do occurred not in the cold and damp forest, but in the Hill House kitchen with no one else around. Typically, Herbert had stayed up late, alone, sitting on a kitchen stool and leafing through a magazine with one hand. In his other hand, he held a knife, carving thin slices of salami and feeding them to the Mia's Saint Bernard, an eater. About 3 o'clock in the morning, he heard someone coming down the stairs. Mia appeared in the doorway of the kitchen in his nightdress. "What are you doing?" said Herbert. "You should be sleeping." He could tell by the lines on the man's face that Mia had been stirred from a deep sleep. "I must go for a contact," said Mia. "You're crazy," said Herbert. But Mia said that he had been contacted, and he had to go. After awakening Popeye and asking her to fix him some coffee, he gathered up his clothes, boots, and leather coat, and walked out into the night. An hour later he returned, drank another cup of coffee to warm up while he took off his clothes, then went back to bed. Why did he do that? Herbert asked himself. Nobody is here. Only me. He doesn't need to do it for me. It's crazy. When there are many people here, maybe he would feel he must give a demonstration. Maybe he would go for a pretend contact. But there is nobody. Nobody. Four. In the early fall of 1964, Timothy Good toured India as a violinist with the London Symphony Orchestra. The son of a violinist, Good had begun playing the violin at age 5 and later trained at the Royal Academy of Music in London for 4 years. Now, at age 22, he had been with the London Symphony Orchestra for a year, playing in the first violins. The tour of India, his first, was to last several weeks, taking Good to all of the country's major cities. In New Delhi, the orchestra stayed at the Ashoka Hotel, and one afternoon between rehearsal and the concert, Good took some time to browse through an artist's boutique that earlier had caught his eye in the lobby of the hotel. He had been struck by several paintings, especially a collection of oil portraits of Indian leaders including Gandhi and Nehru, surrounded in pale auras. As he looked through the glass at the paintings now, a woman in the shop approached him and invited him in. Good introduced himself and learned that the woman was Elizabeth Brunner, the artist who had painted the unusual portraits. The two of them talked at length about the paintings and Brunner's inspiration, then the conversation led to things metaphysical, and finally to Good's hobby, the study of UFOs. In the mid-1950s, while still in his teens, Good had become fascinated with the existence of flying objects no one seemed able to explain. Pilots observed them, radar confirmed the pilots' observations, yet the objects always outmaneuvered and outpaced the fastest jets. Good wondered, as did many people, if the governments of various countries knew more about these mysterious objects than they were telling the public. Now traveling all over the world with the orchestra, he had the opportunity on his own to investigate reports of strange sightings and claims of contact. As he explained more of his hobby to Brunner, he sensed in her someone who also believed in the existence of extraterrestrial societies and their probable visitation to the Earth. After they had talked on the subject a short while, Brunner made a suggestion to Good that he found intriguing. As Good remembered, she said, "You ought to meet a chap who's fallen in love with a spacewoman. He's just left India." Unfortunately for Good, the man had been expelled from the country only a few days earlier, allegedly for having no money. Brunner surmised that the man was asked to leave the country for another reason, which she told to Good. She felt it was perhaps because he talked too much, he recalled. "It's a dumb thing to talk about UFOs in India. She advised me not to do so, publicly at any rate, while I was there." Brunner then showed Good an article from the New Delhi Statesman dated a few days earlier, September 30, 1964. "The flying saucer man leaves Delhi. Swiss claims he has visited 3 planets. Good began reading. In the article, the writer gave the flying saucer man the pseudonym Edwards Albert. He wrote that he found Albert sitting bare-bodied in one of the cave-like monuments at Merauli near the Buddha Vihara. The man had been living in the cave for 5 months, ever since his arrival in India. "Mr. Albert sounds rather weird," wrote the reporter. "But then he clearly is not eager to talk about his experiences, which, to say the least, are remarkable. Indeed, the little that he has to say has to be pried out of him. He doesn't want publicity, he doesn't care if anyone believes him or not." The man had revealed to the reporter, "I have not only seen the objects from outer space, but I've taken photographs and even traveled in them." He showed the reporter about 80 photographs, all taken with an old folding camera and neatly kept in an album. But when the reporter asked for 2 or 3 of the photos to illustrate his article, the man politely declined his request. He told the reporter, "I can't spare them." He said he had taken over 400 such photos, but most of them had been stolen in Jordan and India. Since the reporter could show none of the photos to his readers, he took notes on what he saw as he viewed the album and used his descriptions to give the readers a feel for what Albert had photographed. "The objects in the photographs vary in size and shape," he wrote. "One is a globular object with a round disc in the center, another is funnel-shaped, a third is like a neon lamp, a fourth is a big, bright cross and others, bright zigzag lines. Some of these have been taken on the ground and some flying in the sky." The man now sitting in the cave claimed he had taken the photographs in Greece, Jordan, and India. Good read on. Besides having photographed the ships, Albert claimed to have been visited frequently by entities from elsewhere in the galaxy and to have traveled to at least one other inhabited planet. "On this unusual planet, all of the objects were white," he told the reporter. "And the space people themselves looked very much like Earth humans, except they were taller, had a certain glow about them, and were spiritually more advanced. They expressed themselves through the transmission of thought patterns." The reporter noted that the man's belongings consisted of only a few articles of clothing, his photo album, a folding camera, and 2 small bags. Traveling with him was a pet monkey named Emperor. At the conclusion of the interview, Albert and Emperor were to pack up their few belongings and, with a new friend from Germany who had lent Albert a small amount of money, to begin hitchhiking back across the Middle East and eventually return to Switzerland. Before they parted ways, he told the reporter, "I have a mission to fulfill," but he refused to say what it was. "I will disclose it when the time comes, positively before a year." "The story of Mr. Albert is as incredible as it is startling," the reporter ended his article. "He proposes to relate to German scientists his experiences, show his photographs and the objects that he says he has collected from the planets he visited. Has Mr. Albert created history, or is he a mystic who has let his imagination run wild? Time alone will tell." Many years after the article appeared in the New Delhi Statesman, the reporter, S. Venkatesh, responded to a letter inquiring about the mysterious Mr. Albert. He wrote, "I distinctly remember meeting the man and he seemed, on recollection, very serious about what he was saying. I for one would be eager to know what he did later on, whether he encountered any more spacemen and ships and whether he disclosed anything to anyone later, as he promised he would." Timothy could read the article twice and returned it to Elizabeth Brunner. She herself had met and spoken to Albert, but other than suggesting another friend who might be able to help Good locate the man, she could add little to what was in the article. She said he was obviously full of this girl, remembered Good, in love with this girl from outer space. She added only that she felt he was sincere, and very enthusiastic. Not certain of the man's name and having only the few clues with which Brunner and her friend could provide him, Good decided nevertheless that the story was sufficiently interesting for him to pursue. "I don't like to make judgments on people until I've met them myself," said Good later, "so in 1965 I eventually tracked him down. It was very difficult." The man lived in eastern Switzerland, in the foothills southeast of Zurich. His real name was Eduards Albert Meyer. During a winter concert tour in 1965, the London Symphony Orchestra played in Zurich, and while there, Good went looking for Meyer and found that he was living with a sister in a small village not far from Hinwil. I actually went out there in the snow and got out to his house and he wasn't there," recalled Good, "so I just had brief words with his sister, who didn't speak any English. She gave me a number where I could contact him, and I spoke to him on the telephone afterwards."